Committee, I welcome you with open arms.
Is that so? How late do you stay open?
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
I hope they are watching. They'll see. They'll see and they'll know. And they'll say, why, she wouldn't even harm a fly.
What's up, everybody? You're listening to NoCo Cinema here on WGN Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago. I am Tom Hush.
And I'm Connor Cornelius.
And we're back again for yet another fantastic week of Chicago film talk. Connor.
And what a fantastic interview we have for you today.
Oh, yeah. It's gonna be fantastic, especially if you're a fan of, if you like horror, if you like comedy, if you like...
Both?
Yeah, both mixed together in a sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
Today we are going to be talking with director... and film critic, a man that of many talents, Mr. Jason Kaufman. He has directed a film called House Sitters. It's actually available on Amazon Prime right now. If you have the Amazon Prime subscription, you can go and watch this movie.
And you should.
All right. Yeah, you gotta go see it. And it's really fun. Connor and I both watched it. And, you know, when you watch movies as part of, like, I don't know, your job. I don't know if I'd call this a job, but
it's not a job, but it's a passion, really.
Yeah.
It's a passion.
If you watch movies in that way, sometimes you get a little bit jaded.
Right.
You get a little bit like, yeah, I've seen this before, blah, 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 blah. But watching House Sitters, it was a movie that had me grinning ear to ear through a lot
time.
Of it.
Yeah,
the whole time. Fantastic characters, fantastic filmmaking.
Great writing. Has a lot to say about both the genres that it employs.
And we're so lucky to have Mr. Kaufman. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So let's jump into kind of your background as a film lover and a film fan. What really got you into the movies in the first place?
I mean, when I was a kid, I watched a lot of like local. I grew up around sort of the Indianapolis area, so we had Sammy Terry was our local horror host. So I watched a lot of Sammy Terry when I was a kid, and that just sort of naturally, you know, I got into high school and rented out all of the horror sections and all the local video stores, anything I could find. Which in Indiana, admittedly, you know. In the 90s.
It's a little sparse.
Pre-internet. Yeah, not a huge...
So horror anything, was like so. Your first love then in terms of genre?
Yeah. Yeah, I was always like obsessed with horror movies.
Yeah.
From pretty early on, so...
Yeah, I mean, horror is a great entry point because when you're a young person getting into film, you know, you can't just jump... Or maybe you can, but I found it difficult to just jump into the classics necessarily. You know, you want to watch Casablanca, you want to watch Bicycle Thieves, you want to do all these things that are considered classics, but it can be a little bit alienating because you don't necessarily have the language of cinema down.
Right.
And I found in myself, you know, I grew up watching Disney, you know, Disney first, all that kind of stuff. But once I wanted to get a little bit more serious in my love of film, moving into horror kind of teaches you this interesting language of film and what can be done. And, you know, and it feels dangerous. There's something dangerous about going into the video store and you see like Chopping Mall and you're like, oh man, this looks crazy. I bet this is really going to mess up my, you know, mess up my brain. Let's go for it.
That's the thing about horror that's so great is it's like the outcome of watching the film is it could fuck you up.
Yeah. Jason, how did it affect your brain? How did it affect your development as a cinema lover?
Well, I guess I had a similar thing where like I sort of just moved into that. In the horror because it was what I was interested in and it was sort of accessible, you know, everywhere had stuff, and then I kind of went out from horror into other stuff. So, you know, one time I went to the video store and instead of renting Don't Look in the Basement, I rented like Barry Lyndon or something. Like and started moving around. But horror is just, it just interests me because it's wide open, you can do anything with it. So it lends itself to examining things from interesting angles and also it's just fun.
Right.
Yeah. So it's so much fun.
Do you think that it had an influence on your sense of humor?
Probably. Yeah.
Well, it gives you a little bit more of a darker edge.
Yeah.
And that darker sense of humor, I think, is something that, I don't know, I've always found more interesting. And I love regular straight up studio comedies and things like that. But especially in today's day and age, that dark sense of humor really comes in handy, especially if you want to comment on something, especially something that can be considered, difficult to parse. You can use that dark sense of humor to explore kind of gender politics, especially in cinema. You can use that to explore sex and drugs and all that kind of stuff, which at one point, I'd say horror was how people talked about those things. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think a lot of stuff, especially in the 70s when horror was really kind of growing up or getting weirder and more intense, I think a lot of that stuff, there's a lot going on there. I mean, you can watch the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and just be grossed out, or you can go read reams of academic papers about what the Texas Chainsaw Massacre is like actually about, and it's fascinating stuff.
Well, I mean, you're not just a filmmaker, but you are a film critic and someone who really loves talking about film. How do you approach that sort of almost academic lens or critical eye when you come to something like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre? How do you parse through what a horror movie is actually about?
Well, I don't feel like I'm super academic or intellectual. I think it's sort of the Ebert school is like watching something, trying to figure out what the aims of it are and trying to evaluate how well I think they reached for what they were aiming at. But yeah, I've read a ton of books on like film theory and horror and all that sort of thing, but I don't usually get into much of any of that in my reviewing and stuff. It's mostly just I try to take every movie on its own terms, and that can be, you know, everything. It's like if a movie was made for $1,000, like I'm not going to hold that to the same standards as Get Out.
No, right, of course not.
So
I think that there's you're a contributor to Daily Grindhouse, but you're also an author. You put together this awesome book called The Unrepentant Cinephile, which you were kind enough to bring two copies for Tom and I. And as I was sort of parsing through it before the episode here, I saw this explanations page, which you wrote. And I think that there's you explain your philosophy of film going, which I think it speaks a literal volume to your process. It's you say that I believe that any film worth watching is worth watching at least twice, and that any film not worth watching at all is worth watching once.
Yes.
And I love that. I love that approach because that means it's like, okay, so even if you see something that maybe turns you off, you'll still watch it one time just to be able to, just so that you can evaluate it on its merits.
Yeah, and you learn from every movie that you watch.
Right.
And sometimes you learn a lot more from movies that you hate and that you think don't work at all. So you learn, you know, to figure out what doesn't work about that. How, you know, if I'm going to do the same similar thing, like how can I avoid these pitfalls or whatever?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Do you believe that there is such a thing as a good movie and a bad movie, or just movies that you like for certain reasons or don't like for certain reasons? Is there an objective good and bad?
I think more toward the latter. I don't know about like an objective scale mm-hmm. of quality. Obviously there are things you can look at. Again, if I'm looking at like Barry Lyndon and I'm taking into account like the cinematography and everything, that's going to be different from some movie made for $800, right, you know, in somebody's apartment.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's jump into the movie that you made, House Sitters. It is would a horror comedy be a fair way to approach that?
Yeah.
Horror comedy that deals with two friends who have a business who they put themselves out there to house sit.
Yep.
They are really a lot of chemistry on screen between these two. Basically, it's follows a little bit of that classic horror plot where it's like they go into the house, things go from bad to worse, and they think everything's gonna be fine. Very much not so, but it does so in a way that's really fun, and like I said earlier, has you grinning from ear to ear. So tell us about where you came up with the idea for House Sitters and why you wanted, you felt like you wanted to really make this one.
There's so many things that sort of came together that made it happen. Mostly, I met Jamie, one of our leads. She plays Izzy in the movie. I met her several years ago through a friend, Jeff Burnham, who was my assistant director on this. Back long ago in the misty past, Facets used to do midnight movies.
Right.
And they did a night school series. And Jeff was showing Yor, the Hunter from Beyond Time. And as part of his presentation after the movie, he did an interview with Yor and, like, Yor's caveman girlfriend. And Jamie played the caveman girlfriend. And she was hilarious. And I really wanted to, like, make a movie or do something with her, like a short or anything. So, like, every time I tried to come up with something, I had her in mind. Like, I should figure out how to put Jamie in this. Or, like, and it just never worked. And so that simmered for years. And then I was working with Yadi, who was we shot in her house, and her house is just packed with equipment because that's her hobby. So
yeah,
she had like an Ursa camera and like a Blackmagic cinema camera and just everything, a green screen.
Yeah,
so.
Everything under the sun, you know.
Yeah.
And so that was the equipment you used.
Yeah, yeah. We got to talking and we were both like, you know, she's like, I'd like to work on a feature. And I said, I would also like to work on a feature. Mm-hmm. I did it, actually, some friends and I did a Kickstarter back in 2013 for a feature, and we shot 70% of it, and then it just collapsed, and we never finished it.
What caused the collapse, if you don't mind me asking?
It was everything that could happen, like, just yeah. went wrong, like,
right.
I had a bunch of personal stuff where I ended up having to be out of the state. Mm-hmm. Like, I was in Indiana more than I was in Chicago that year, and so the scheduling kind of got mixed up and with everybody, and like I couldn't be there when anybody else could be there, and then some of our cast moved away and all this. It was
a bunch of different things.
It was just a perfect storm of awful, yeah. awful circumstances.
So House Sitters is like a triumphant return, almost.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, we talked about it, and I was like, I really, when I wrote the thing that we were shooting back in 2013, I didn't think it was that ambitious. Mm-hmm. And then we started shooting it, and we got into it, and I realized that it was ludicrously ambitious for a first movie with, you know, very small budget. So when we came back and Yadi and I were talking about what we were going to do, I just had the idea to pare it down as much as possible. One house, you know, keep the speaking parts, as few speaking parts as possible. So just, again, just kind of reeling in the ambition to like one place and like, what can we do in this space?
So House Sitters is a truncated version of the feature you tried to shoot in 2013?
No.
Oh,
okay.
No.
So this is a different, completely different
story.
I see.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and when it comes to filmmaking, especially on a small budget, I think that might be something that a lot of first-time filmmakers do. You know, they feel that they're ready, they want to make their big first feature and come in with a splash, and things kind of get a little bit out of control. And, you know, when it's your first feature, I'm not a filmmaker myself. I can't even imagine even putting together something like House Sitters, which I feel like comes off really tight and really fun and really well put together. But I imagine that the process to get to that was a lot of work. Can you tell us a little bit about getting everybody together, getting that script together, and actually shooting the film?
Sure. The script was weirdly difficult. Like, I've had situations where I've had ideas and or people have come to me with projects, and I've worked out first draft scripts in like 2 or 3 days. And House Sitters took like a month for me to write for some reason. It was really difficult. But once I got everything in place, like, here are the characters, here's the place, here's what's going to happen, like, it started to sort of come together. Jamie was obviously our first cast member. And I told her I gave her the script, and I was like, we have to have somebody that you can play off of really well. Do you have any suggestions? And her friend Annie just happened to be moving to Chicago for a short time right when we were going to be shooting. So I just took Jamie's word for it and just sent Annie the script. Everyone else was audition. Mm-hmm. We did auditions at the Harold Washington Library.
Oh.
Downtown.
Good acoustics.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was kind of awkward. And at least one point, because we were in like a little separate room.
Uh-huh.
That I didn't realize had like an opening out to the larger space. So yeah, somebody was auditioning and just like yelling and screaming. And then I realized that they could probably hear that like on the entire floor. But they didn't kick us out, so I guess it was fine.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you gotta. There, I would say Harold Washington is a great supporter of the arts.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
That's very cool that you got to audition inside, like, yeah. This beautiful historic building, you know, doing. Did you have to do, like, test screams? Like, okay, I need to know that you can really wail.
Yeah.
What constitutes the perfect scream or the right scream?
Oh. It's hard to. It actually helped when we could watch them later and see like what the sound was like. Because mm-hmm. if someone screamed and it didn't really blow out the mic, it's like, could have given us a little more.
Yeah, you need that intensity.
You want it. You wanted it to blow out the mic.
Yes.
You wanted it to peak.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
So, on the in the script, I was curious. It breathes very well. It seems very organic, and I guess that probably speaks to the casting because they play off each other really well. But I was curious, how scripted is the film? Are there pockets for improvisation, or is it all like down to the T written out?
No, there's a lot of improv, especially between Jamie and Annie. I gave them co-writing credits because my screenplay was basically a blueprint. Like, here's mm-hmm. what people are saying, what they have to say, what the lines mean. Like, but you can get there however, like, feels right. Mm-hmm. So I always tell everyone, like, if anything in the script feels weird, like not something a human would say, then feel free to say it like an actual person.
Well, that would have worked for the demon, right?
Yeah, he never had lines. I went back and forth on that a lot, whether he should have lines or not. But in the end, it's just the weird groaning noises.
Yeah.
I think work best.
Well, and I think the improvisation comes out really well. As you mentioned, the chemistry of the two leads was super. I mean, when you have a movie like this, it's super important to have everybody attached to these leads. And I think they handled it so well. They've got such great timing, such a great understanding of who exactly they're playing. They know that they are these kind of two stoner chicks.
Ne'er-do-wells.
Yeah, ne'er-do-wells, who are just so much fun to spend time with.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just the plot itself, but I really found myself enjoying just watching them, spending time with them. And I really like this, what you did, or at least what I feel that you did with having essentially a female-led comedy, which is, I think, a great trend that we're seeing in both smaller films and big films. People want more of that. People want to see more women on film. Were there any specific inspirations in terms of having the two female leads go together? Was there a way that you wanted that to be handled on screen?
Well, I mostly wanted them to be believable as, you know, mm-hmm. characters who've known each other. And Jamie and Annie have known each other since, like, junior high or something. And they both had extensive backgrounds in comedy and improv. So I just let them loose, and they were mm-hmm. perfect. But, I was thinking pretty specifically, like, Broad City.
Yeah.
I was watching a lot of Broad City
I think there's a lot of that energy in there.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that fun energy.
I started pitching it as like, it's like Broad City and Ghoulies.
Yeah.
Like put together.
And the comedy itself, I think there's a lot, so many lines that just really had me like kind of giggling.
Oh, dude.
Even right off the bat when you have the little throwback to 1991.
Yeah.
She goes in the bathroom, opens a window, is smoking a cigarette, talking on a landline.
Like, meep, 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 meep.
Yeah, that, I was laughing so hard. Yeah. I was laughing so hard. The voice on the phone is like just blethering. Nothing's coming out.
The other part that got me, which I thought was fucking hilarious and really speaks to the subversion of the movie itself, is when they're Annie, Izzy, the person that plays Izzy, right, is the character, and she's in bed with her boyfriend, and then you hear this like,
and
it's
God.
Her cell phone ring, and it's not the score. I thought that was fucking brilliant.
That was a fun little subversion. The mention of a ka-single nearly killed me. That is a word I have not heard in a long time. What kind of comedy do you enjoy? Because I think I saw a lot of stuff that I could point to, maybe like, oh, there's a little, maybe a little Edgar Wright in there with a lot of the visual gags that were going on. A lot of maybe Kevin Smith style in the very regularness and the very comfortability of the actors, and also a little bit of that stoner humor as well, that really play as well. How did you approach the comedy in the writing process?
I have to acknowledge Kevin Smith as, because mm-hmm. I saw Clerks in Indianapolis at the Castleton Arts Theater in like 1994, 95, whenever it first played. Like, there was a horrible radio station that had a preview screening, and I went and saw it. It's like, this is amazing. Yeah, it's like this guy made this movie for nothing, and it's really fun. So, I mean, that sort of spirit is definitely in there. Although, as far as what he's gone on to do later,
I would almost say that this is like what I wanted Yoga Hosers to be. I think House Sitters is it. Because having the female-led comedy, watching, I hate to compare, because as you said, we don't want to compare a movie that's made on a lower budget to something like Kevin Smith later on, where he has a bigger budget and can kind of do a little bit whatever he wants, essentially. But the chemistry was not there for Yoga Hosers. The comedy felt really stale and like almost a parody of Kevin Smith comedy, whereas yours felt like what Kevin Smith would have wanted, which is something personal and something that you know that's actually funny. Like, there are things that I watching, I'm like, this is something that the writer and director thought was actually really funny.
Yoga Hosers didn't even look fun to make. It didn't even look like the actors were having fun.
Meanwhile, we have House Sitters. Yeah, looks very fun to make. What was the mood on set? What was it like working with these guys?
Mostly it was upbeat. Mostly it was really fun. We shot the whole thing in 10 days. It's three weekends, Saturday and Sunday, all day, and then like four evenings during the week at different locations.
And that's a tight schedule.
Yeah. I mean, you look at it and it all takes place in one house. It's all supposed to be in, within a few hours, you know, like maybe 8 hours of time. So it's pretty compressed, but yeah, even that is not easy to get. It's not, right. If you're doing one take of everything, maybe it's easier, but we definitely weren't doing that. I had a lot of footage to work with, especially because we were leaving room for people to improvise and stuff.
Did you edit the film?
Yes.
All right. How did it feel being the writer, director, editor? Like,
Weight of the world.
Yeah. Is that easier for you to feel like, okay, I have kind of control over what's going to happen? And although you do have the improv, and there's a level of letting things breathe in the film, but did it feel good knowing that you had final cut on how this was going to look and kind of sound?
Yeah, I did all of the post-production, which is why it took so long. We shot in July, August 2016, and I finished the final cut like May 3rd of this year.
Wow.
So
I mean, it's a process.
Yeah, I mean, I did the editing, the color, the sound. I did everything. And part of that is because I did want to have control over how it looked and how everything worked. And part of it was just because I didn't have any money to have anybody else do it. Like, I didn't want to ask somebody, like, can you edit my movie for free? Like,
yeah.
Or can you do color correction on every shot of this movie for nothing?
Like, yeah.
I just, that was not an option. So I just,
yeah. Hey, necessity is the mother of invention, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How much, if you can reveal to us, what kind of budget were you working with on this?
I think I've been saying, like, the very low four figures.
Okay.
I don't know exactly. I think ballpark, I may have spent like $1,500 during the shooting of the movie, and like 800 of that was probably food.
Yeah,
it was almost all food because I couldn't afford to pay anybody.
No.
So I was like, I'm going to make sure you guys are eating well, at least,
yeah,
while we're shooting the movie, if mm-hmm. I can't pay you. So,
but $1,500, that's a tight budget. It's something, but definitely not what people would expect. Something I notice is that people kind of have this inflated idea of budgets, like, oh yeah, $1,500, that's quite a bit of money to make a movie. It's really not anything at all.
Yeah,
especially if you have to spend money on feeding the actors, and you know, when you can, if you're able to, paying the actors. You know, some productions I know around Chicago are using SAG actors. What is it about low budget filmmaking that you think provides such a creative little, I don't know, pocket of filmmaking? Because I've seen so many low budget films that do something so creative. You know, we're talking about bigger names like Kevin Smith or even like Quentin Tarantino with Reservoir Dogs. That's essentially what, two locations for Reservoir Dogs? You've got the warehouse and then a few scenes
in an office,
you know, diner, really not a whole lot going on, super super cheap, but it comes to be one of the more creative movies out of that early 90s independent film movement. So why low budget film make? Why make movies at this level?
Well, I mean,
other than necessity,
necessity is obviously the main thing, but you can do anything, I guess that's the main thing. It's like in the 90s and before, you know, 10 years ago, you couldn't shoot a movie for less than, you know, several thousand dollars and get it actually out anywhere. Mm-hmm. especially back in like the 90s, you know, you had to shoot on film or you were shooting on VHS, and like,
yeah, and that was its own
thing. But yeah, it's not like you're gonna shoot on VHS and get in multiplexes.
No,
except for the movie Boarding House, which did that.
There you go.
Really? In the early 80s, there was a movie called Boarding House, shot on VHS, transferred to 35mm.
Good lord.
And seeing a 35mm print of that movie is so bizarre.
What fresh hell is that?
It's like pressing an MP3 to vinyl. Like,
oh god.
It's really weird. But yeah, like now filming equipment is so cheap. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got a camera on your phone.
Yeah, I mean, you have movies like, let's say, Sean Baker's Tangerine, right, which was a fantastic film shot on like an iPhone 5S. Yeah, 5S. Unbelievable. And it just opens up so many opportunities for storytelling. I know the fact that this movie is on Amazon Prime, I find to be really great. Like, that's a great platform. I've noticed a lot of people that we've talked to, if they're able to get it onto Amazon, I know Netflix has like a ton of restrictions on what you can get on there, but is Amazon Prime easier to get a film on there?
Yes.
Really?
I mean, Amazon Prime is basically YouTube now.
Yeah. You like, just gotta upload it? Yeah.
All you need is video content and a checking account where they can send royalties. And
that's right.
Wow. You're on. Like, and that's it.
What kind of royalties are they paying out? Is it certain, like a cent per view or something?
Oh god, that would be amazing. No, it's not at all. It's like I think it's 6 cents per hour. They parse it out in minutes streamed.
So
it's 6 cents per hour until you hit 100,000 hours, and then it jumps up to 10 cents per hour.
Oh,
yeah.
So it's really, like a multi-tiered it's a multi-tiered royalty scam,
pretty much.
But still, it gives you the opportunity to say to someone, "Hey, if you've got Amazon Prime, you can watch this as part of your subscription."
Yeah.
Have people been checking it out? Has it made it easier to market the film, essentially?
Yeah, I mean, I've not done a ton of marketing per se, because I submitted to tons of festivals. And the festival submissions were, I mean, I almost spent like half what I spent the first time making the movie just in festival submissions. and that became just such a nightmare and just so miserable and discouraging that I finally just gave up and was like, let's just put it on Prime. Mm-hmm. So that's why people can actually see it. But yeah, I mean, I set up a URL, watchhousesitters.com, and it just goes directly to the Amazon page. Okay. So it's been really... Amazon, it is kind of ridiculous. I have some short films that I made with some friends, mm-hmm. and they were available for free since 2013 on Vimeo and never really got watched. I uploaded two of them to Amazon Prime at the end of May, and they've been watched like exponentially more times than they've ever been watched. And I've done nothing to promote them. They're just they're just on there, and people
Someone might come across it. Yeah. You know, which is useful. It's a little bit of that video store experience in a sense where it's like you're just kind of walking, you're digitally walking in and browsing and be like, oh, maybe this looks interesting. This could be fun. And someone might stumble upon a really great, you know, personal independent film. What was the URL again? Watchhousesitters.com.
Watchhousesitters.com. Yeah.
That'll take you right over there.
Yeah. Go straight to the Amazon Prime US page.
Yeah. And so, can we talk about just how many, how much of a well-rounded package this movie is? How many movies is this? It's kind of a monster flick. It's a haunted house flick. It's a trippy, like, space-time commentary on horror movies. Like, it's a comedy. Well, it's got a fucking ridiculous, absurdist intermission.
Oh, we have to...
We have to talk about that.
There's a couple more things that we definitely need to touch on, but let's go to this intermission because I found it to be, while, you know, totally bizarre, definitely fit the feel of the film. If you could describe a little bit this intermission that you included in the middle of the film.
I want to hear you describe what it's about.
It's about a puppy who wants to be a building. And it's pretty simple, really.
Now, and this is all done with computer graphics. There is a puppy who wants to be a building. A cat speaking Russian?
Norwegian, I think.
Norwegian.
Okay. Yeah. How many languages are there? Was it just English and Norwegian?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you speak Norwegian, or did you just found someone that speaks Norwegian?
No, it's a computer
thing. It's a computer.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, go to show how much I know. I kind of thought it was real. I kind of thought of her. Wow.
No, she sounds really good.
That's a very good computer speaking Norwegian as a cat.
Yeah.
Well, they'll take us all over someday.
Yeah. But why did you feel that you wanted to include it to break up the film a little bit?
When we the shooting strip was 70 pages, and one of the first things I thought when we were coming at this is like, I watch a ton of indie horror movies, and like the number one problem I have with most of them is that there's like people make their first movie too long.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I've seen so many like 100-minute, 110-minute. Mm-hmm. Movies made for nothing that, you know, they might have some good stuff, but overall it's just
there's like just 10 15 minutes that you can totally just get rid of.
Yeah, you can just chop and it'd be no problem. So I didn't want the movie to be any longer than like 72 minutes at the absolute outside. So I wrote the script, 70 pages, we shot everything in it, I cut everything together, and we came in at like just under an hour. And I don't know how that happened. I think it's just we shot. Everyone was kind of speaking pretty
quick.
Yeah, yeah, it's almost like it's like screwball. Like it's like bam, bam, bam.
Yeah,
bam.
Yep.
So I had to. I wanted to at least get over an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So part of it is just padding. It's like we had to get over an hour. But I am always, if I'm going to do something like that, I want to do like the stupidest thing possible, like the most ridiculous, like not even trying. It's like of course this is padding, but like look at it.
But it was such a good padding. Like it just once I saw it, I was like, end of part one, interesting. And then it goes into this totally bizarre.
I was just like watching it, like, oh, there's a squid flying down the street. Well, okay, here we are. Nightmare world.
Not to put a label on it, but I felt like this could be in like Adult Swim, you know, on cable, and people would definitely just watch the intermission. And I would hope, I mean, I hope that this intermission sells you on the rest of the film too, because the rest of the film's great. But it just had me absolutely crying with laughter. It's so ridiculous.
It's sort of the gauntlet, I think. Like if you get like what we're doing, people are really, they're either really into it or like they just don't understand.
That's the trial by fire.
But. Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And well, I will say that this is a movie that definitely, if you're into low budget horror, if you like that type of thing, this really engages those tropes in a way that doesn't feel ironic, but feels more genuine. I didn't feel like you were trying to make fun of or take the piss out of low budget horror. This was you saying, I love low budget horror. Let's take a little bit, let's mess around with it and make it fun and funny and tongue in cheek for those who do really love the genre, but not make fun of them for liking a genre.
Yeah.
I did want to know, is there a specific commentary that you wanted to make with the movie? Because I had a takeaway, a very specific takeaway, but I was curious if you had something that you were trying to say with the movie, maybe like even a, because it's clear that you love indie horror, but is there a critique that you wanted to make about it?
Maybe just in more, maybe more in the approach that we took than the actual movie itself.
Okay.
Part of it was the, I don't want it to be too long. A big part of it though was, again, I watch a lot of indie horror movies, and if you watch a lot, you see a lot of the same thing over and over and over and over again, which can get exhausting.
Right.
I don't remember, there was something I saw recently, or maybe around the time we were working on House Sitters, that just sort of like was the line for me. It was like, I'm never watching another movie that's just some dude murdering a bunch of women, like,
yeah,
for no reason, like, that does nothing, like, gives you nothing different. Like, I'm just tired. I just got sick of those, like, same slasher movies, same song. And it's not that, you know, those kind of things can't be done well.
No.
One of our voice actors in the trailer, John R. Hand, made a movie called Joel that just came out recently, and technically that fits into the, it's just like a guy who murders a bunch of women, but like it's based on a real story, and it does, it's like fascinating with like the psychology and everything. Mm-hmm. So you can do something like that and make it interesting and make it worthwhile, but I just wanted to go as far in the opposite direction as possible. Like, don't take the movie should not take itself super seriously. It shouldn't just be the same zombie slasher stuff that everybody makes because it's quote unquote easy.
Yeah. And likable. People know what it is.
Yeah. And just, you know, make characters actual characters that you want to watch and spend time with. Cause again, a lot of the indie movies, I don't know why, but they write, all the characters are just the most reprehensible characters. It's not even cathartic watching them get murdered. Just like, I just wish I hadn't spent any time with these people.
Well, I am curious to hear what your takeaway was, Connor.
So my takeaway from it was that there is a, it's basically what you just said, is that there are these observable tropes in indie horror that just get tiring, right? They're just tired premises where the male, like, women are constantly being murdered and punished for their sexuality, and they're like underwritten characters if they seem to have been written at all. And the monster is just this like evil demon that was summoned, and once it's summoned, it wants to wreak havoc on the world and end the world that assuming it also lives in. So like, what's the motivation there? I think that what I loved most about the movie is that you really flip all of it on its head in a way that is, it feels fresh, and it's cathartic at the end without being a bloodbath necessarily. And like, you make, it's a female driven comedy at its core, like a Broad City kind of a thing, but the men are sort of the sex objects, as Tom was the one that put that line in my head earlier.
That's what I really thought was funny about it, is that it's, you know, the women are using the men as their sex objects. I think it's kind of exemplified for me and it's done in a way where it's just, where it's not sex negative, where it's just like, oh, look how disgusting they are. It's very sex positive in a way. And the scene where They wake up in bed. Izzy wakes up in bed with her boyfriend, and you have this whole little comedic beat where she keeps smacking him on the ass, and it's just like, it didn't feel gross. It felt so, what a loving smack on the ass.
Yes.
Like, it was,
it felt very comfy to watch.
Yeah, very cozy, very couple-y, and you know, one of the things that they're doing throughout the first half of the film is that they're just sitting on the couch smoking weed and watching old pornography.
Yeah.
I love the big box Pappy's porn porn box.
She's like, yeah, I got the porn, but we don't have any food.
Yeah. She gets like a whiff of the box and she's like about to throw up.
That was an improv. That was not in the script. That was her. Just
fantastic. So, House Sitters, really fun. If you have Amazon Prime, please do check it out. It's an hour long, and I think you're going to come out of it really, really enjoying it. Again, the URL, it's going to take you right to the Amazon page to watch it, is watchhousesitters.com. You can also, where can we get, is the copy of The Unrepentant Cinephile, where can we find that? Is that on Amazon?
Yeah, it's on Amazon also. It's all just right. Like a print-on-demand thing. So.
And it's... it's huge. I don't know. Let me see if I can get the get some gnat sound there.
It's really heavy.
It's huge. Yeah. But I love it. It is this something you need to have in your house if you like film, if you like reading, really you know, a person who loves these B movies, loves kind of low budget stuff. I mean,
it just seems like the kind of thing, what do I watch tonight? Fuck searching through Netflix for 3 hours.
Well, yeah.
Let's open to a random page.
I mean,
Anaconda. All right, fine, I'll watch it.
And it's a great
Addicted
guide.
To Murder. Let's watch that one.
Yeah, I mean, this is the kind of book that once you get it in the mail after you purchase it.
Order on demand.
Yeah. It seems like the kind of thing that you can go through and it's nice and big and you can make your own notes in a sense. You can give it, you know, I have a couple books like that. I have like Roger Ebert's The Great Movies Volume 1 and like the New York Times 1001 Movies to Watch Before You Die. And this is very similar in a sense where you can, I like to make notes in the books and be like, give it my own star rating and kind of see how I feel about each one and just kind of go through each movie and have a good time with it and get all your thoughts on it. Is there anywhere that we can follow you on social media? Where can we read you at Daily Grindhouse?
Yeah, I write for Daily Grindhouse and Film Monthly. I just finished covering Fantasia for Film Monthly for the first time. I think it's the first time the site's covered Fantasia. So
great.
That was fun. I'll probably be covering Fantastic Fest for Daily Grindhouse this fall also.
So that is must read. Must read what's coming out of Fantastic Fest. That's a big festival. Do you wouldn't happen to know Matt Cipolla, would you?
I've never met him. I know he started writing for Film Monthly not too long ago.
Yeah,
I've seen his byline popping up over there.
Yeah, definitely. I think you guys would get along very well.
Yeah.
I think you both have a great approach to film. Again, Jason Kaufman, director of House Sitters, writer for multiple outlets, Film Monthly, Daily Grindhouse, and also the author of The Unrepentant Cinephile, collected reviews of cult, exploitation, horror, and independent films. Jason, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
All right. This has been NoCo Cinema on WGN Plus. We are your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago. I am Tom Hush.
And I am Connor Cornelius.
And we will see you all next week.